Yeah, thank you very much, Donna. So good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving the opportunity to speak. So in this talk, I would like to tell you about some recent work, which is outlined here. So the global question we would like to address is what we can learn from energy spectra of finite size systems, so finite volume systems of Hamiltonians at their quantum critical point in 2+1 dimension. That's a kind of an open question, how these torus energy spectra look like, and I would like to motivate this and point out some connections or absence of connections to conformal field theory. And then I would like to illustrate this question in a number of applications. So the first two are the spectrum at the critical point in a 2+1D Ising transition, so in the standard 3D Ising universality class. So we have worked out the characteristic spectrum of that quantum field theory in finite volume in the Hamiltonian setting. And then we point out differences to the so-called Z2 confinement transition, where you go from a Z2 topological ordered phase into a confined phase, which is topologically trivial, and that transition we call Ising star, because they're, even though they share some critical exponent with the standard Ising universality classes, on the level of the torus kind of partition function, there are some crucial differences which we can see in the spectrum and that we would like to address. And so that's part of the same preprint, which is on the archive. And then the last part, as an outlook, we would like to have a look at a different perturbation to the toric code, where, among other things, we actually find evidence for a 3D XY star transition between a Z2 topological ordered phase and a Z2 global symmetry breaking transition. So it is a direct transition, and we think that transition is 3D XY, and we provide some evidence also based on the energy spectrum on the torus. So let us start now with discussing torus energy spectra and quantum field theory. So as a start, you kind of all know, I guess, that if you have a quantum field theory, a conformal field theory, you have kind of a dictionary of local operators, some fields OI, which have corresponding scaling dimensions delta I. These are a property of the quantum field theory. And they, for example, appear in the correlator. So if you correlate these field OI at different positions in space-time, their spatial dependence is governed by this exponent 2 times delta I. So if you know the set of fields and their scaling dimensions, you already know a lot about the properties of your field theory. And so that's kind of this part of this conformal data if you're talking about the conformal field theory. And from a computation point of view, it's of course interesting to figure out whether we can find those fields and their corresponding scaling dimensions in numerics. And in one dimension, so in one space dimension and one time direction, it's this is very kind of well established that there is a relation between the Hamiltonian setting and the 2D kind of StatMech setting with these scaling dimensions. And this manifests itself that if you're looking at the finite size energy spectrum, they actually arrange into conformal towers. And this is due to some, if you reason on the level of field theory, there is a mapping between, say, two-dimensional space, or R2, there's a conformal map onto the cylinder, kind of, so a circle S1, that's the spatial aspect. At this direction, R, which is infinite, is then the time direction. And so that's like the Hamiltonian setting where you quantize your theory on a spatial domain S1, and you have the time direction R, and there's a conformal mapping. And that mapping is not just a mapping, kind of an abstract one, but it actually maps the spectrum of scaling dimensions, so the eigenvalues of the dilatation operator. They actually become the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian, because time translations along that direction are translated into eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. So this is well established, and here there are some examples. So this is a finite size energy spectrum of the transfer field Ising chain on a rather small system, and you can get that from numerics or use to the Majorana kind of solution. And it actually turns out that this low energy spectrum, you can also understand it as a certain set of combination of conformal chiral branches of your Ising CFT in two space-time dimensions. And here is a more advanced spectrum, which I guess has obtained here was obtained here at KITP and Station Q by Adrian Fagan and others, where the tricritical Ising CFD spectrum is, for example, witnessed here in some strongly interacting anionic chain. So in 1 plus 1 Ds, you see there is a well-defined and well-established relation, which in numerics is actually nice because you can really read off the scaling dimensions or the content of your partition function of your conformal field theory by studying finite size, kind of 1D tori energy spectra. And so we then basically ask the questions what happens in higher dimensions. And unfortunately, that mapping still exists, but not in the correct geometry, which we can address numerically easily. So in more than 1 plus 1D, there's still a relation, but it does not hold for tori, but only for the sphere. So the corresponding mapping goes from RD, where D is like total space-time dimension, and it maps onto the surface of the D minus 1 dimensional sphere times R. And in higher dimensions, so for D larger than 2, this is not equivalent to the torus, as you can see easily here. And so, but the first mapping is actually something which kind of in the field theory world is used a lot, because this concept is then also called radial quantization. And so if you're actually able to quantize your theory on the spatial domain, which is the surface of a sphere, and you can actually treat that, then you can look at your Hamiltonian spectrum and you can read off the scaling dimensions of your theory in the Hamiltonian spectrum. But from a computational numerical point of view, this is a bit hard, because typically we work with lattice models, not exclusively, but mostly, and it's actually difficult to triangulate or to put a mesh, a lattice, which you can refine in a clean way on the surface of a sphere is kind of hard. And so this is not something which is easily accessible. But on the other hand, to put lattices on a torus is something which we know to do, or the community knows to do well for a long time. And so analytically, because this mapping does not extend to the torus, so there's no known relation how the spectrum of a Hamiltonian kind of the quantization on the torus is exactly related to the spectrum or the fields in the flat space or on the sphere. Since there's no known relation, this is kind of unexplored how the spectrum of the torus looks like. And the aim of our endeavor is basically to explore what is there from a numerical point of view and see how much structure we can actually recover or how much we can actually learn by looking at the available torus spectrum. So basically the questions we asked and we're going to address is, what are the energy spectra on tori, and which are numerically accessible, because we can do simulations with various methods on a torus. So the first question we would like to address, whether there's actually a universal low energy spectrum, and whether it's actually accessible using the numerical tools we have at hand. Then we would like to know whether we can really kind of obtain it numerically and how it looks like. And we would also explore to what extent there is an analogy to the spectrum of scaling dimensions which you would get in radial quantization. So let us now start looking at the specific microscopic model and convince ourselves that indeed there is some universal torus spectrum which depends not on the ultraviolet cutoff, but perhaps on the shape of the torus in the following. And to do that, we start with a particular model. So as I said, we want to investigate the torus spectrum at the quantum critical point. And so while we do not expect that the exact spectrum of the scaling dimension is recovered, we still hope that the spectrum is universal. It means it's UV or lattice independent for a given shape of the torus. And the shape of the torus is in the field theory language is the infrared cutoff. So it's kind of the form of your finite volume in the space direction. So that's the shape of the torus, or the modular parameter, if you wish. And so there is possibly some dependence on the spectrum on that shape. And that is like related to this famous question where you can hear the shape of the drum to some extent. But we do not actually address this question, but it's possible that your spectrum depends to some extent on the shape of your torus. And so the actual model we start with our study is the transverse field Ising model on several lattices. And here it's just written down so that you know what we're actually simulating to start with. So first of all, here is a look, a glance at the raw energy spectrum across the transition. So this is some exact analyzation data for different system sizes, plotted here as a function of the transverse field Hx, so one of the driving parameters of this quantum phase transition. And without going into details right now, but here, if the transverse field is small, you can see that this kind of a twofold ground state degeneracy building up, and in the limit of the apse where H goes to zero, you basically have a two ferromagnetic ground states which are there, and there's an even and an odd combination, and these are the two levels which you see here. On the other hand, if you make the transverse field very large, you get a unique ground state which is aligned with the transverse field. So there's a unique ground state at this level here. And somewhere on the way between this twofold and this unique ground state degeneracy, there is the quantum critical point. So here for that model, it is well known what the precise value is from, say, quantum Monte Carlo. But what the question is basically whether we can see whether the spectrum which we find here at the critical point, whether it's actually universal to some extent. And something which is already known from previous studies is that if you have a spectrum at the critical point, then you actually expect it to scale with the linear extent of your system. So what we're doing here is measuring gaps above the ground state, so that's this delta, and then we multiply it with square root n, where n is the number of lattice sites, and that's like a proxy for the linear size of our system if you take the square root of our total volumes of spins. And so you can also see kind of that here these lines for different gaps, they actually cross around the critical point, and that basically means that this collapse is really well established. So now we actually, in the next plot, we sit exactly at the critical point, and we calculate the spectrum, so E minus E naught at the critical point. We multiply it with the square root of n, so where n is the number of spins, and then we divide that by an arbitrary constant delta naught, which is chosen such that the first level above the vacuum, above the ground state, is kind of goes to 1. And the reason for that is kind of in this setting, we don't yet have access to something like the speed of light. This is not known here. So we take an arbitrary scale for our spectrum. And then we can see that if we arrange our spectrum as a function as 1 over n, where n is again the volume in terms of lattice sites, we see that the data, at least here at the gamma point, these are the blue symbols, so in the center of the Brillouin zone of our lattice, they have a quite a nice and clean scaling behavior. And then the green points are here in the momentum grid of our lattice are the first momenta away from the center of the zone. They have a slightly more scattering behavior, but we can also extrapolate them reasonably well in 1 over n. And so the larger symbols are from exact ionizations, where here we have system sizes up to 40 spins. But then, since that might be not convincing enough a priori, we have also obtained spectroscopy data for some of these gaps using quantum Monte Carlo, and these are these red symbols, so they come from quantum Monte Carlo, where here we have targeted like the first spin odd level at all momenta, and you can see that these extrapolations based on the ED data and the larger QMC, they within reasonable precision, they lie on top of each other. And so we basically claim that these extrapolated results here, so these blue circles for zero momentum and the green ones for the first momentum away from the center, these are now kind of data for the conformal field theory of this Ising field theory on the square torus, because that's kind of the simulation setup, the square torus we have used here. But right now you can ask, okay, but that was now for a specific square lattice as the underlying microscopic lattice, like the UV cutoff. Let's see how much that depends on for the same shape of the torus on another lattice. And so as an alternative, we have chosen the so-called square octagon lattice, which is a lattice which has the same C4 type symmetry. And we also, kind of the infrared cutoff is given by a square torus shape. And if you do the same exercise, we have less data points because the unit cells are larger. But in the end, we actually see that both UV cutoffs after extrapolations actually give rise to the quantitatively the same spectrum. So here we see that the same torus shape actually seems to give the same torus energy spectrum for this quantum phase transition. And then to see how much these results actually depend on a different shape of the torus, we take lattices which have a natural six-fold rotation axis, and these are the triangular honeycomb and Kagome lattices. So we can simulate them as well, and you see the data here. And again, if you take these 1 over n corrections into account, you can extrapolate this and you get the characteristic spectrum, and they match very well across the 3 samples with the same infrared cutoff, which in that case is a parallelogram with equal sides and a 60-degree opening angle. And that's actually equivalent to having a hexagon kind of unit cell or a torus shape. So here we see that's the spectrum on the hexagonal torus. And you can see there is also a slight difference. I mean, one of the kind of important or obvious differences is that the first momentum, which is green here for this hexagonal tori, is actually 6-fold degenerate, because the first momentum appears 6 times in the vicinity of the gamma point, whereas here there is only it's only 4-fold degenerate. So you can definitely see that the spectrum depends on the shape of the torus to some extent, but otherwise across different ultraviolet cutoffs, it's actually the same. So I think that's convincing evidence that we're able to obtain the spectrum of the quantum field theory on a torus of a given shape, irrespective of the ultraviolet cutoff. And so we see that is really the torus spectrum of the CFT at the critical point. And now we have this numerical data, and in order to check whether there's really also field theoretical backup, we have joined forces with Seth Witzet and Subir Sachdev, and they developed the formalism to actually calculate this torus energy spectrum within epsilon expansion. And that's not completely trivial, because somehow you have to take care of the fact that you work on the torus while changing the epsilon, so while going from 4 to 3 dimensions. So this was a little bit more involved, and there will be a paper describing this technique in more detail, but what they're doing is basically working on the level of phi to the 4 theory in epsilon expansion, and then to leading order they actually get the torus spectrum as well from epsilon expansion. And here you can see represented now in a different way, where we plot the spectrum normalized by the actual speed of light, which we can measure using quantum Monte Carlo. So in the numerics you can also get it afterwards. And here we plotted kappa is then the linear momentum. And you can see that this torus spectrum, you can represent it that way. And the message is basically that the full symbols are the ED or QMC numerics, and the empty symbols are from the epsilon expansion. And even though it's not high precision matching qualitatively, it's always when there is a numerical level, there's also an epsilon expansion level close by. And on the level of the spacing between the levels, the agreement is actually quite good. And we will also see later that the qualitative difference between other quantum phase transitions are usually that large that this level of precision is actually good enough to tell something about the nature of the quantum phase transition. And also we can also now have a brief look on how this spectrum compares to the sphere. So these are our numerical and epsilon expansion results for the torus. And if you take, for example, results for the scaling dimensions of the 3D Ising model, say from conformal bootstrap, and you build a hypothetical spectrum of the theory on the sphere, which we do not calculate, but we say how it should look like based on the knowledge of the scaling dimensions. And here that's angular momentum as the good quantum number on the sphere. You see that you have a vacuum, then you also have a branch of the sigma field, you have a branch of the epsilon fields, you have the stress energy tensor, and you have the first descendant of the epsilon field. So that's basically how it looks like on the sphere. And at the very hand-waving level, the fact that you have a vacuum and then you have a first Z odd level here, which disperses more or less linearly, but with some deviations from it, and then you have a blue symbol here like the epsilon, that's actually something which is more or less in common. So even though there's no quantitative matching, so we're not saying we can read off scaling dimensions in contrast to here, still there's some kind of qualitative agreement that the sequence of level, at least the lightest one, the lowest one, they share some similarity. And so we already think that's an interesting observation. Okay. So that much was now for the standard Z2 symmetry breaking transition, where you go from a paramagnet to a Z2 symmetry broken phase. And now in the next step, we would like to understand what the spectrum is of the Z2 confinement transition, which we have already written here. It's called Ising star, so there will be some difference. So the microscopic model we are studying, I will come in a moment. So just for summary, but C2 liquids have already been discussed. So C2 liquids are topological order is very, very popular. So these are states which have a 4-fold ground state degeneracy on the torus, but the degeneracy is topological and not related to symmetry breaking, in contrast to the twofold case we had before. And so the model we're studying is basically the toric code by Kitaev with additional perturbations or deviations, and then we can actually drive out of this this transition. And so we go from this deconfined phase, which is the topological phase, to the confined paramagnetic one, and that's why it's called the confinement transition. And this transition has been studied before using other different techniques, and it's believed to be in the 3D Ising universality class. But if you look in detail, we will see that there are differences in terms of kind of the partition function. So the question we ask here, and we're going to address, is whether the torus spectrum at criticality is identical to the symmetry breaking case we have just discussed, or not. So here the Hamiltonian we're looking at is the toric code Hamiltonian. So we have the star and the plaquette terms, which here are chosen with equal coupling. And then we have chosen one particular magnetic field. So it's H times, and here we couple to sigma X. But you could also couple to sigma Z, and the problem would be dual. But here we have chosen the sigma X as the external field. So that's the parameter we drive. And now here to the left, we have actually obtained the spectrum on the torus at the critical point. And there's actually also some kind of mapping, which I do not discuss here, where you can map the toric code microscopically for this particular perturbation onto a transverse field Ising model of some dual of some plaquette variables. And if you do that, you actually see that the spectrum contains levels which were present in the transverse field Ising case here. That's the symmetry breaking case again. But you can see that the spectrum overall does not look the same. So for example, here you can see that the four topological sectors, which are exponentially close together in the Z2 topologically ordered phase, at criticality, they also scale as 1 over L. And you have four of them, and one of them is a doublet. So together, altogether, there are four states. And they're actually, even at criticality, they are still close together, and they scale as 1 over L. And there's actually a sizable gap in the torus spectrum until you reach here the first blue level here. And that's actually then the same one as this epsilon torus level, which we had before. But here, for example, you can see that the sigma field, so this Z2 odd level, which we had, that's actually not present here. But just overall, we see that this is the torus spectrum for the confinement transition, and this is the torus spectrum for the symmetry breaking transition, and obviously they do not agree. And so the reason is what's going on. Yes? Yeah, here it's chosen such that the epsilon T is actually matching on both sides. Yes? Now, for this Hamiltonian, which we study, if you take this one here, then and you perturb with that one, then actually one of the plaquette variables, the one which is not commuting with this one, so the B's here, they actually become Ising variables, and you can microscopically on a torus define this mapping. So it becomes a transverse field model, transverse field Ising model. Pardon me? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's one of the. No, I will talk about that. So the fact that it's on a torus is important, and the loop quantum numbers which you have, they enter the spectrum as well. I will come to that. Yeah. But still, it's microscopically, it maps onto a transverse field Ising model of the B variables. Yeah, on the torus here. Okay, let me continue, and then we can see what's... Okay, so the explanation why the two things are different is that the operator content of the two transitions on the torus is different. So in the Z2 symmetry breaking case we discussed before, we have in the spectrum, we have Z2 even and odd levels, and only one set of boundary conditions, the ones which you inherit from your lattice model. And since the transfer field Ising model, we were simulating on a torus with completely periodic boundary conditions, we only had one set of field theory levels. Now, in this confinement transition, which we dub Ising star, there are only Z2 even levels. So there's a selection rule where all the Z2 odd levels in the Ising model on the torus are absent. They are not present. And if you choose periodic boundary conditions in the toric code on the microscopic model, the four different boundary conditions by the loop operators become simultaneously apparent. And that's what we say, is that this can be understood at the microscopic level in the toric-Hod Hamiltonian. This has been understood before. And you can also write down a general field theoretical considerations where you arrive at the same conclusion in, say, the, some appropriate phi to the 4 theory. And so in the Ising star case, the fact that these Z2 odd levels are absent basically means that the magnetic sector is completely absent, and the torus energy spectrum reflects this fact. So it basically means that in the toric-Hod, even though you have an Ising-like transition, I mean, it's very closely related to Ising, but there's no magnetic sector. So you cannot write down any operator, set of operators, or a product thereof, which will actually measure something like the critical exponent beta, which you have in the Ising model, or eta, which measures is also coupling to the spin channel. This is not present in that confinement transition. So this is everything which is Z2 odd is absent. and so at criticality, these four topological sectors, which come from the loop operators in the toric-Hod, they also scale as 1 over L, but they are much closer together than the next level of, above them. So these are the remnants of the four topological sectors down here, and there's a sizable gap until the first level comes, and they, you can understand them coming from assembling data from the Ising model with different boundary condition sets, and you glue them together, deleting all the odd fields, C2 odds, but taking all four different boundary condition cases, periodic antiperiodic cases into account, and then we can reconstruct the torus spectrum. But this kind of reflects the fact that the partition function is different between a confinement transition and the standard symmetry breaking transition. And here we also have data from the epsilon expansion, and they also show reasonable or reasonably good agreement between the two approaches. Okay, and then at the, as a last example, we perturb the toric-Hod with yet another type of perturbation, or and then we will see that we actually are able to recover a 3D XY star transition in some cases. And so here we're a bit more explicit now. So the goal, why are we studying that, is not just for kind of because we don't know what else to do, but the question is, we want to study a quantum phase transition between Z2 topological order and spontaneous global Z2 symmetry breaking. And we want to explore whether there's a direct transition possible, and if it exists, what are its possible properties. And so what we're doing is that we take the toric-Hod and we add an Ising interactions. Before, we perturb it with the magnetic field. Now we're putting Ising interactions, so this destroys the exact solvability. And here, since there are on the toric-Hod lattice, there are different types of bonds. We introduce some type of bonds, for example, a JI and the JI2 type interaction. These are Ising interactions between different variables. And for example, there's the green ones here between I and J, or here a blue one between K and L. And here is another one between M and N. These are the Ising interactions on the level of the toric-Hod. And they actually translate into different interactions then on these variables which live in the center, which are the B, the plaquette operators. And what actually happens is that in this case, if you perturb the toric-Hod with these interactions, this actually maps onto a particular 2+1 dimensional quantum Ashkin-Teller model. So before, by perturbing with the magnetic field, we were mapping the toric-Hod, the plaquette variables on the transverse field Ising model. And now if you're perturbing the toric-Hod with Ising interactions, you actually get an Ashkin-Teller model. And so what happens here is that the close by Ising interactions, like the green and the blue ones, they actually translate into Ising interactions between the red kind of Ising variables in the center here. But they actually only couple the same sublattice. So for example, this interaction couples circle with circle, so there's like an embedded checkerboard square lattice. And this one here, this blue microscopic toric-Hod interaction translates into an Ising interaction between these two. But here on the yellow level, you can actually see that this Ising interaction, the toric-Hod, translates into kind of a bond term in this Ashkin-Teller. So you have an energy type correlator between two distinct sublattices in these, which are embedded in the toric-Hod. And therefore we have an Ashkin-Teller model. There are two kind of checkerboard sublattices which have Ising interactions between them, and they're coupled by an Ashkin-Teller like interaction, so an energy coupling between the levels. And so here you can see one of the sublattices, and the other one is the one with the circles. So there's a particular Ashkin-Teller-like situation. And so now we have And if you do are more careful, you can also see that the loop variables in the Tori code, they also translate into boundary condition, which are different in the Ashkin-Teller model. But first of all, let's look at what is the phase diagram of the quantum Ashkin-Teller model. And that's actually not so well studied in the literature. So here we did some new QMC study for it. And this is the part of the phase diagram. And so the paramagnetic phase in the Ashkin-Teller model, that's the high temperature phase in the classical sense, if you wish. And there's another phase where both sublattices are ordered. So in the histogram, you see four peaks here. And there's also a certain line in the parameter space, which we looked at, where there's actually, there are two independent Ising models, transverse field Ising models, which basically live on two sublattices, which are not coupled. And there it's clear that the transition, if you drive it with a transverse field here, that there's two copies of an Ising transition here exactly at this precise value. And then we did simulations also along this line in larger parameter space, and we're convinced that on that side the transition turns first order, but on that side the transition actually becomes 3D XY in the Ashkin-Teller model. And you can also see histograms which show nice features here. But since this is a talk about spectroscopy, I will show on the next slide also the energy spectrum. And I would also like to mention that this structure which we present here is actually also in agreement if you think about some kind of Ginzburg-Landau type description of this phase transition, then actually this actually maps to some extent to a two-component phi to the fourth theory with cubic anisotropy, and then you know that there's like an O2 fixed point, there's a two Ising copy, and then it can also run to strong coupling and being first order. That's all kind of in the possibilities, and here we see that the sequence is as we say here. And then what is interesting, if you translate that back from the Ashkin-Teller model back into the Tori code, and you apply the selection rules and the fact that you have several boundary condition sectors, then actually the first order turns kind of into first order star, although this is not really make sense. And then the 2D, two copies of 3D Ising become something like two copies Ising star. And then what is really interesting is here that this transition then becomes 3D XY star, and it will just show on the next slide what that actually means. But here there's a transition, that's what we were looking for, a transition between Z2 topological order, because the paramagnet turns into Z2 topological order in the Tori code, into a phase which has Z2 spin symmetry breaking magnetic order. So there's a direct transition, and the transition is in the 3D XY star universality class. And what is nice is that if you look at the torus spectrum, because it's about the spectrum, so here this is the case which we can reconstruct by our known data for the 3D XY case. So these are two independent copies. You can reconstruct the spectrum by knowing the spectrum on one sublattice. That's the result here at the decoupled point. We have some additional data for standard 3D XY. And these are the results from the Ashkin-Teller model in the middle. And you can kind of see that as you deviate from the Ising model, you can see that in our numerics, and there are levels which were far apart. In the Ising case, they actually come close together. And if you admit some error, it actually seems, you can see that even the torus energy spectrum here in that range looks much more like the prediction of the 3D XY class than the two Ising copies. And I think that's a nice confirmation that even small scale exact stabilization torus spectra are able to tell you that this transition is more likely to be 3D XY in the Ashkin-Teller model than its two copies of Ising. And then you perhaps want to understand how you go from the Ashkin-Teller model 3D Ising, 3D XY to XY star. So here the way to go is that you take all fields with periodic boundary conditions first from the XY model. So here this is like SC equals zero, or charge zero, charge plus minus one, charge plus minus two, and so on. And then this is charge zero again. And then what you do is you delete all odd charge sectors. So you remove them. So some of these things here are missing. So that's XY even. And then to assemble XY star, you take all boundary condition sectors of XY even and you superpose them. So there's like periodic, periodic, antiperiodic, periodic, and antiperiodic, antiperiodic, but always charge even sectors. You build them together and then you can reconstruct the XY star spectrum. And that's what you actually observe in the perturbatory code across this 3D XY star transition. Okay, and with this I come to the end. So we have shown that universal torus energy spectra of, of CFTs describing quantum critical points are accessible numerically. And we think that the torus energy spectrum contains valuable information on the hand-waving kind of operator content. So it's able to discriminate Ising from Ising star universality class, or also this two times Ising from 3DXY. And a lot of other kind of universality classes can be addressed. So we have also data for O2, O3, Wilson-Fisher fixed points. And also we're looking into Gross-Neveu critical points. And also we think we could possibly contribute some insights on the confined criticalities, for example, like claims of emergent SO5 symmetries. We think there's some chance that using torus energy spectrum, using exact analyzation or perhaps quantum Monte Carlo, one is able to further constrain possible theoretical field theories describing deconfined criticality. And we also hope to spark some interest from the quantum field theory side, kind of thinking more deeply what kind of fundamental things can be said from a field theory point of view on the torus energy spectrum, kind of from the field theory side. And with this, I would like to thank my collaborators, so Michael Schuler, who's a PhD student, Louis-Paul Henry, a postdoc in Innsbruck, Zed Witzit, a PhD student in Harvard, and Subir, you all know him. And I would like to thank you for your attention.
Questions?
So in the last case, we discussed the connection to the Ashkin-Tella model. What if you said only the nearest neighbor interaction between the spins, the Ising spins? Then you should get just a transverse Ising model?
But it's two copies of a transverse field Ising model. So this is like a multi-critical point.
Right, so that's why you didn't want to study that.
I mean, that one is easily understood because it's two independent copies. Yep. And then if you assemble the spectrum, there's just some global constraint, like it has to be global even. And with the boundary condition, that's kind of easy. But it's not representative because there's actually a whole line which is XY or XY, XY in the Ashkin-Tella model. So the two Ising is part of it, but it's a multi-critical point. And if you detune from it, it's either first order or you go 3DXY.
Yeah, and a quick follow-up question, if I may. Could you, is it obvious where the XY degrees of freedom are coming from? Because if you look at the Ashkin-Tella Hamiltonian, it's sort of not exactly obvious, right? You have interactions, quadratic and biquadratic interaction between mu x on a plaquette on between the sides. But is it obvious where the XY, like how?
It's emergent symmetry, but it's part of these cubic anisotropy models. I mean, there are. Like O2 critical points, and if you perturb them some way, the XY behavior remains, even though you have microscopically broken down the symmetry to some discrete one. But if the symmetry is discrete but high enough, you're still not flowing away from the 3DXY universality class. So these are old results, which are, I think, that it's part of this cubic anisotropy business.
Could you go back to where you were showing the phase diagram of the Ashkin-Tella model?
Yeah.
So, it's surprising to me that the transition between the paramagnet and a phase where only one of the sublattices is ordered is also 3DXY. Do you have an intuition? Like, I would have guessed that it would be an Ising transition in which, you know, just one of them orders. Do you have an intuition of how that comes about?
Yeah, I think if you think in terms of like 3DXY models with like some cosine terms, then actually the transition across here, where, I mean, here it's hardly visible, but here the four maxima which you get in the histogram, they are like on the diagonals, but on that side they are like on the axis. But actually that's just a different orientation. But this is a dangerously irrelevant perturbation at the critical point. So whether you go across this transition with this locking potential, or if you go that transition with the rotated one, is an irrelevant perturbation at the critical point. So it's important to determine the nature of the phase, but it's irrelevant at the transition. So we think that this is something which the transition does not feel, even though the phase beneath it is different. That's also things which are known to happen in the 3DXY universality class, that this particular clock anisotropy is not relevant at the transition itself.